Before there was IMDb.com, there was Zach and Dustin.
You know those guys who think they know everything about a movie without having to go on the internet to look it up? That's us, but maybe only for the years 1981 through mid-1989.
No, I'd say late 1978 through early 1992. Either way, we know movies. And even more specifically, we know soundtracks from those movies.
Yeah, this is $2 Late Fee with Zach and Dustin.
This is the podcast where we pick a movie and soundtrack from our youth that we loved and see if it still holds up today.
All in the spirit of positivity and togetherness. Thanks for listening. On to the show.
Hey, I gotta be honest with you, dude. I am really excited about this interview with Darren Dalton.
Oh, yeah. This one was like, what do we call it? Like an auspicious coincidence of sorts?
Yes.
Because when we recorded our original Red Dawn episode 100 years ago, we didn't know who our guest was going to be. But I don't think we could have asked for a better guest for our show. Like he was wonderful. I was blown away. I love those interviews where we just kind of like get on the line, we get on the old horn. And it's just like talking to an old friend. And those are my favorites.
Yeah.
And this one was.
Yeah, likewise.
This one was like that to the max, baby.
Yeah, from the minute we started the interview, it was like three guys hanging out, having a conversation about the good old days of the 80s and just big smiles and positive energy. And Darren told great stories about The Outsiders and Red Dawn and Best Times.
Yeah, for those not familiar, I mean, Darren plays Daryl in Red Dawn, who, student body president, one of those characters that you kind of love to hate, you know, in a way. And and of course, he also plays Randy in The Outsiders, which was his first feature film, along with the rest of Hollywood at that time, young Hollywood.
Seriously.
In the 80s, yep. Everyone wanted to be in Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders.
And he got to celebrate his birthday with the cast of The Outsiders. That was a fun story.
That is right. And that's a story that our lucky audience will hear.
Absolutely. They're going to hear a lot of great stories from Darren throughout our interview. It's cool. It's like he's had a wild ride from being in some really great movies from the 80s and writing and teaching and being a father and just a lot to share in a short amount of time.
Yeah, for somebody who gets like a lot of success quickly at a young age, he is, you know, he's so grounded as a human being, which is really amazing. And I will say too, I feel like we've been very, very fortunate with all of our guests that we've had on the podcast, you know, this past year, you know, some 15, 16, 17, 17 guests that we've been so fortunate as far as people being open and receptive and kind of vulnerable in good ways. And just like really hearing about all the stuff, which I love, just like the highs and the lows and the experiences. And sometimes it's behind the scenes and sometimes it's just like, here's a little tidbit of something you might not know about your favorite movie or your favorite character. And so, so today we got more of that goodness.
The goodness from Darren Dalton, the whole kit and caboodle.
The Darren Dalton goodness, as we are now calling it.
So without further ado, we present to you the one, the only, Darren Dalton.
Enjoy.
Darren Dalton, thank you so much for being on $2 Late Fee.
Of course. Are you kidding? I paid enough $2 late fees. I should be a co-host.
Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, depending Please. On how this goes, we'll talk. We'll draw up a contract.
Back in the day, I kept Blockbuster in business for a while.
I would say I zeroed out a lot of $2 late fee charges on girls that I fancied when I was working at the video store. You want me to take care of that late fee for you? You got it.
Nice. I love it. I love it. You worked there. That's fantastic.
I worked at a video store called Video Man, and Dustin worked at a legit Blockbuster.
I worked at Blockbuster, but I felt like we were limited to how many late fees we could just take off before we had to go to a manager, and then it was like a weird thing. You know, like I was probably authorized to take off like $2.60 or something.
Yeah, you had to get someone to sign off on
it. Yeah, and then I'd be like, I need a manager for this $4.
Yeah. I miss the smell of Blockbuster, though, don't you? I miss the smell of it.
Those microwave popcorn bags.
Great point.
And then they had those bucket of popcorns that you could stick in the microwave.
Oh, yeah. Please put the Reese's up by the counter. That worked for me.
Good to go.
There are many places that have distinct smells, and I think Blockbusters and like airports, to me, are like the two.
Yes.
And a Foot Locker. Yeah, the smell of a Foot Locker. The things we could think about before COVID hit. So
that's right. We miss anything other than our own houses right now. Exactly.
Well, so we are recording on quite possibly one of the most historical days of recent times.
What happened? Is something going on? Zach?
A rumor that
Blockbuster's coming back. They just announced it, and they're all coming back. 75 franchises across the county.
Yeah. No, good day here. I mean, I woke up to about 4 inches of snow. I'm in the mountains up above LA, so I woke up to about 4 inches of the first snow of the year. Oh, got a little coffee going, got a little fire in the fireplace, you know.
Glorious.
Are you in Big Bear
I'm not. I'm in Little Bear. I'm in a place called Wrightwood. So I'm like just towards the LA side of Big Bear.
Oh,
yeah,
glorious.
You can go up another 1,000 feet to Big Bear. It's beautiful.
That's a great way to start your day, and I'm glad you're joining us.
Do you like have a place up there, or are you just visiting, like renting for the?
I've lived up here for 7 years now. Oh, you know, man. The thing about it is, I can be in Beverly Hills in about 1 hour and 20 minutes, and I'm 5 minutes from Mountain High Ski Resort. So the winters are kind of fun, and it's away from the rat race, you know. It's a little more creative for me up here, and you know, I got a 7-year-old and a wife to go with him and all that stuff. So, you know, we just we're
Oh, you got the wife to go with him.
I got the whole set.
came with the wife. I see.
It was the 2-pack. Yes.
You could buy the 7-year-old solo, but
he got the 2-pack exactly. With the ATV vehicle that comes with it.
That's right. But no, I love it up here. I lived in Los Angeles for a long time, and just kind of needed a little bit of getaway. Maybe, you know, especially once the kid came around, I was like, okay, let's find someplace a little quieter.
So you returned to the woods where obviously as a Wolverine, you spent a lot of time and you like that. No, I'm kidding.
This is a very Red Dawn-y type of day up here, actually, because it was cold the whole time there. It was very cold.
Oh my gosh. I mean, obviously we'll get into that in a minute, but you've got a 7-year-old kid, 7-year-old son.
Yeah. Yep. 7-year-old son.
I am the parent of a 6-year-old son, and we are very much into G.I. Joe right now and everything retro. So
yes. Mine is like just insert Minecraft in there and you've got my kid. It's just pretty much it's all about Minecraft right now.
It's kind of a life changer, not gonna lie.
Minecraft.
Well, it was an absolute yes. Yes. Once I discovered those ocean monuments, I was in. You know what? It completely altered the whole trajectory for me, man. I love being a father so much. It opened my eyes. I waited a long time to do it, you know, and it's a good situation. It's a tough thing here now with the lockdown pandemic situation. I kind of had to be a 7-year-old, especially this last summer.
I feel
So, I mean, that was actually fun, but, it's tough for him not to just be able to go out and play with the friends and things like that.
Well, let's hope that the light at the end of the tunnel is getting brighter and brighter on every day, hopefully. So,
yes.
Amen.
And, you know, I think it's really...
It's a UV light. It's a UV light. You should actually...
Kills all bacteria.
And the planet.
Yeah, exactly.
Kills everything.
Stick in the right places. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
I think, please. Fantastic. We don't.
This is good. I should check on this. Are we R? Are we PG-13? What are we talking about here?
We are hard R.
We are hard R.
Okay, good.
Not in like a gross way, but you know, not in a gratuitous way. But we welcome authenticity.
Yep. Freeform.
Yep. Okay, good.
You know, don't hold back. There's no editing. The only editing that we do is inserting a trailer here or a quote from a movie or something like that. So something fun. But just the fact that you're joining us, and it really means a lot to have you on the show. It's kind of crazy to think about the fact that the 80s were such a long time ago. But the reality is, you've had a long standing history in Hollywood. Like you writing, directing, acting, a little bit of everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. It was interesting. I've always loved story, just story and storytelling and things like that. And the way that I kind of fell into it, I mean, I was an actor prior to The Outsiders, which was my first movie, right? Mm-hmm. I did a lot of stage and things like that in high school and in theater there in the local community in Texas and New Mexico and things. And I just kind of fell into it. I had a couple of friends in the acting, the drama club or whatever, and they needed a ride to an audition at the Hilton downtown in Albuquerque. And mm-hmm. I had a car, so I fit the bill and I took them. Janet Hershenson came out into this crazy blonde haired afro came out into the hallway, and she looked at me and she said, you know what, you should come in too. You should come in. So I did. And then ultimately I ended up getting called out to Los Angeles a couple of times and flying to New York. And it was just very storybook the whole way that I got in through the door in Hollywood, and it's been good ever since. I mean, I in it but not of it is kind of my thing. I like it, but I'm not going to be the guy you're going to see. Red carpets are awesome, but I'm just not the best at that. But I do love storytelling, and that's where it all, especially the writing and directing now that I'm starting to do, is a real comfort zone for me.
I love it, Darren. Let me ask you that very first audition when you drove your friends down to Albuquerque. Are you still friends with those guys, and how did that change your relationship with them?
That changed quite a bit right away. You know what? I am good friends with the people that I spent time with in doing plays and things like that in high school. It was a really good little community group. Facebook, that's the thing, ties us all together, right? So it definitely changed the trajectory. I wasn't like the total nerd in high school, but I certainly wasn't embraced as the guy or anything like that. It definitely raised the rep a little bit.
But were they annoyed? Were they mad? Were they jealous? Were they like, you're going to LA and you're, see you guys, I'm going to see Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, yeah.
Have
exactly.
a nice day. Have fun in social studies.
I mean, there is a lot of truth in that. Yeah. The interesting thing is there was another kid from a rival high school that I knew. When I say rival, they were like, we would take first and second in speech competitions and things like that.
Yeah.
And there was another kid that got the call to take the flight to Los Angeles the first time. And he got a call the morning of the plane ride saying, listen, we've seen everything we need to. You don't need to come out.
Oh.
And I was, and he called me, and I was like, I was on kind of going, I'm waiting for my call, which didn't come. And I got on the plane and still waiting for a call, and then got to LA and came to Zoetrope Studios and still was just waiting for them to say, gotcha, go home. And it didn't happen. So it was really, like I said, I was 16, I turned 17 on the night of the New York auditions. There's some amazing. Great pictures. This is not a visual medium where I'd show you guys the pictures. I mean, what's up? But there's some great pictures. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
where the night that it came to midnight that night. And the last night of the auditions for The Outsiders was a kind of an interesting one. First off, the process of auditioning for The Outsiders and Red Dawn as well, but definitely for The Outsiders, was different than your normal audition. Normally you get your 5 minutes, you come into the room, you do your thing, and then they say thank you and we'll call you. And Outsiders was much different. They brought us all into into a soundstage. And when I say us all, I mean everybody that I watched on television, you know, the Scott Baios and the Mickey Rourkes and all these young,
everybody.
You know, Randy Quaid, all these people were there.
I mean, that was the movie and, around town, right? Like yeah. Francis Ford Coppola was making this movie. Every young Hollywood member wanted to be a part of this movie.
Totally.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I get onto the soundstage, Francis is blasting opera. You know, and he's,
of course he is.
It's, yeah, it's just, and then he just kind of picks and chooses, okay, you're going to get up and play this role or we're going to improvise or whatever.
Oh
and like I said, that happened twice. They flew me home and then I came back out and that happened again. And then the last one, when we flew to New York, they had narrowed it down to only one or two people for each role. And the trajectory was going to be that they would record the entire script. We would sit around in a recording studio and they would record the entire script, and each, you know, the two choices would read a half of the script. And I was feeling pretty good about things at this point. And I never really read the role that I got. I always read the Dallas role, the Matt Dillon role. And they cut my, you know, killer 80s fro and everything and greased me back and stuff like that. And, and I get there and I'm thinking, this is looking pretty good, Darren, man. You're looking good here.
Uh-huh.
And then I look up, the door opens and in walks Matt Dillon. And I was like, well, this is over with. I'm done. This is like, he's the most handsome thing I've ever seen in my life. So, I just kind of, you know, we did the read through. And like I said, that night after we all finished the read through, as midnight struck, it was late. And Francis had sent out for, Sara Lee cakes, and they did a little, you know, happy birthday and stuff. So it was great. It was like 17th birthday with, you know, Tom Cruise and Emilio and C. Thomas and you know, quite a few other people that didn't end up in the movie. But it was again, you couldn't have written it better. It was fantastic.
So were you originally lined up to be Randy? You were considered?
Right.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I read other things. I read, you know, everybody read different roles. There were only a couple of people that never really like C. Thomas never read anything but Pony Boy. I think he was just pretty much earmarked as Pony Boy from the start. Right.
Yeah.
And pretty much Ralph, the same with Johnny, you know? I read, you know, read a little Soda Pop and read a lot of Dallas, read a lot of the drive-in scene and things like that. And so, you know, when I got the call about 6 weeks later, they said, you know, what happened is I went home and I thought, well, that's done. And I can't wait to see this movie. It'll be great to watch. And I went home from the auditions and I was getting ready to go do like a melodrama play for $50 a night. I was pretty excited. My parents showed up. I was like, this is great. I'm going to go sign to do this melodrama. And my father said, well, I guess you won't be able to do The Outsiders then. And I was like, what? You know, and then they said, well, they offered you the role of Randy Anderson. And so I, you know, went back and grabbed the script and went through it and went, oh,
Randy,
okay,
this is
fantastic.
Randy.
Yeah, Randy. He's a, wait. Yeah. So shrilly, but at the same time, you know, I'm very grateful for that role because it had a lot of heart to it and things like that.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, and obviously it was just it wasn't Albuquerque. You know what I mean? It was like, I was out of Albuquerque.
Well,
it was good.
Okay. So you, I'm going to go all over the place a little bit here, but you were living in Albuquerque at the time then, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so, very familiar with Albuquerque, and I spent a lot of time in Taos, New Mexico, and worked on the Pueblo and had a history there. But Albuquerque always, no offense.
The
queue. Yeah. It was like, oh, Albuquerque. Okay. So you got out of there. And yeah. Now you're in the, yeah, forget the fact that you wanted to play Dallas at one point or Redford Dallas, but you are a pivotal character in probably quite possibly one of the most memorable ensemble young people films of the 80s, you know?
Absolutely.
And and you mention your name, you mention your character, people automatically know. And no offense, and I hope you take no offense to this, because whenever I'd see you on screen and go, he looks a lot like Neil Sean to me from Journey, but...
I wish I could have played as well as Neil. That would have been awesome.
Well,
right?
Good thing.
Don't stop.
Right.
I love it.
But you know, here you are in this film that is, it's a landmark film. It's a national treasure. I think it's even in the National Treasury of
It is.
Right. Yep. And so you make this movie after you made this, do The Outsiders. I mean, were you considered, like, were people clamoring for you? Oh, we got this movie for you. We got that movie for you. Talk a little bit.
No, you know, this is, I mean, the reality of it is, because of course that's what you think. You know, I graduated from high school early because I went back to high school after filming, and I graduated from high school early. I got in the same car that I'd driven the guys to the audition with in, and drove out to LA, and I knew nobody. I was 17. Wow. You know, now when I look at, cause I, you know, I teach 17-year-olds right now. When I look at them, I'm like, I would never let you go to LA by yourself, you know, but so I get in a car, I come out, I don't really know anybody. And it was a couple of years before Red Dawn. I did another movie in between the two, but
yeah,
it was a minute. It was Martha Coolidge, you know, a very fun movie. I think a movie that was originally written for Belushi and Aykroyd. And then I think that was Paramount. They kind of gave it to Martha and she did it. And I met a lot of great people through that. I met Joanne Barron, who was later became my teacher out here through the Barron Brown Studio. That's awesome. And things. And, that was fun, but that was just a very brief thing. I did a lot of auditioning. And the funny thing is like something, I got this job. I got multiple jobs because, you know, LA, but I was working in the mornings. I'd work really early in the mornings, like 4 a.m. till about 10 o'clock at a call center. And then I'd audition during the days. Mm. And then at night I worked in a great place. I don't know how old you guys are, but there used to be a place called the Poster Mat in Westwood, and Westwood, California out here. And, it was one of those places that sold, you know, like the cool t-shirts, and they'd press on the t-shirt for you and stuff, but they had a candy counter with the gummy, everything and all that stuff. And I was working behind the candy counter when The Outsiders opened at the National Theater down the street.
Yes.
So I would get people, you know, coming in and being like, okay, give me those jawbreakers and some gummy fish. And wait a minute,
it's you.
You tried to kill Johnny. And it wasn't cigars and sunglasses, certainly not right away. And Red Dawn was the first thing that I kind of read afterwards that really kind of lit me up. And also it was the first audition experience that I had that was had some similarity to The Outsiders as far as, you know, finding this good ensemble cast and all that stuff. So, you know, they there was a lot of similarities there.
Did you read specifically for the role of Daryl in Red Dawn?
Yes. When I met John Milius, John pretty much nailed me as Daryl right away. It's one of the few times I've gone in that he basically said, "You've got the role." Mm. You know, he kind of smiled at me when I met him briefly, and then I did a screen test for them, and he just said, "You know, listen, you're the guy." And it was really an enjoyable experience because I got to help them to audition some of the other roles, especially the Patrick Swayze role. I helped them do screen tests for, I think Charlie came in and read for the Patrick Swayze role first, for Jed. And then, there was some cool people that came in and read, and we went through read a couple scenes. They had built a little, you know, like fire, that we all sitting around the fire, and they did a screen test for everybody. And afterwards, Milius, who is a character, right? Milius says to me, after we auditioned, I don't know, maybe half a dozen people or something like that, he comes up to me and he says, "Darren, you're doing a great job. I'm going to give you more kills. I'm going to give you more kills," he says. I'm like, okay. And then the next time I got the script, I had a bigger role. So it was great.
Oh, that's fantastic. Wow. Our understanding of him is that he really just kind of like told it like it was and suffered no fools. And
that's kind of an understatement. As a 18, I guess it was 18, 19 year old at the time, can you ask for a better gig to go play army with this dude?
Really?
You
know,
it was like, and we did a month of really intense training with a guy named John Early, who had more jumps into combat than anybody at the time and stuff like that. And so we did all this guerrilla training, and we designed our own costumes basically throughout that process. And,
cool.
It was so much fun. I mean, you know, I took a little flack later on. People would say, you know, like I ran into a couple of directors. I'd get into the room with them and they'd say, what would make you do a movie like Red Dawn? And I'm like, machine guns? I don't know. What do you want here?
What answer do you want, really? Yeah.
Well, I just listen. And to me, again, as someone who loves story, Milius was a god to me. I mean, this is the guy that wrote Jeremiah Johnson. He wrote Apocalypse Now. I'm like, he was a blast to work with, though. Just a blast. I mean, and like you said, didn't suffer fools, didn't mince any words. I mean, there were a couple of things. I'll tell you one. There was one time in particular that's very funny. That was always funny to me is, you know, he cast us all. We did all the training and things like that, and then he got us all out. I don't know, just in the mountains of New Mexico at one point, and he says, "Men," you know, and of course Leah and Jennifer are here, and he's like, "Men, I didn't hire any pussies.
Oh my God.
So I don't want to talk. I don't want any more actor talk. We've got, we know who we're playing. We know what we're doing. Let's go to war." I was like, this is going to be an experience right here.
This thing's got an arrow. It's pointing.
Where?
Where? Where?
Right here.
The arrow. Where is it?
God damn it! Where's the bug?
They made me swallow it.
Daryl, what have you done?
I went into town.
It got caught. And we got caught! Why?
Because you said we couldn't.
You told them where we were, didn't you? You told them.
My father turned me in. Oh, God, they did things you can't imagine.
You son of a bitch!
You want blindfolds?
This isn't happening. This isn't happening. Jed, let him go.
Shut up, Danny.
He was one of us.
Shut up.
He told them where we were.
He did. Now get your rifles.
No.
What did you say?
I said no. We're not doing it. What's the difference, Jed, huh?
I'll do it.
Shut up, Robert. Tell me, what's the difference between us and them?
Because we live here.
Don't shoot, Jed.
It's real life G.I. Joe. You know, and
I mean, and we listen, when you're 19, especially, and Charlie and Tommy and myself, especially, we were kind of the three musketeers on it.
Totally.
You psych yourself into this experience, and we would lay in our trailer and listen to the soundtrack for Apocalypse Now and things like that.
Perfect.
And just really psych yourself out. You know, there were times. You know, he would put us in those spider holes for the spider hole ambush, and he would put us in there for an extended period before, as they prepped. You know, he would say, "Okay, well, get ready." You'd be kneeled down in that thing with a machine gun, and they'd cover you up, and you'd be kneeling there for a while until you heard, and this was very Milius, until you heard the machine gun that would signal action.
Wow, my God!
So
slightly terrifying.
Just, you know, at the same time, cool. Again, as long as I was on the right side, it was cool.
We're good. Well, we had watched this movie earlier in the year when the pandemic first hit, and we recorded an episode not knowing we would be speaking to you today, and not knowing that we would have a future president in Joe Biden today. Mm-hmm. And so it was, in many ways, it's the tonal shift is really appropriate, because Red Dawn is such a dark film. And I think it oftentimes gets forgotten how dark it is, because the folklore of it is, oh, it's this rat pack action movie, but it's so much more deeper than that.
Yeah.
And your character, while on one hand is perceived as being this dick and traitor, and on the other hand, you're so torn, right? between and I think many people in that position, like, well, put yourself in Daryl's shoes, and what would you do? You know, and it's a really interesting dynamic because it's so it's so intense, and the kids deliver. I don't think I've had seen so much emotion outside of Outsiders by so many kids in this movie.
And you know, it's you make a movie like this, especially, like I said, when you're younger, and it's kind of, you're in this bubble of the experience, and it does take all of your emotions. And of course, when you're 19 years old, you've got a lot to offer as far as emotional stuff goes, you know? So, but I think Milius, you know, Milius, both when I was first hired on to do the movie, it was called 10 Soldiers. It was a script by Kevin Reynolds, and it was a much different script. It was, you know, it was much more tragic. I mean, I know it's tragic now, but the script itself was much more tragic. It wasn't as triumphant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Milius came in, and that's one of the things he really tweaked. But I know that he was, you know, he had conversations with me regarding, you know, the character, and he was aware of the fact that he didn't want to make it, you know, just a traitor. He wanted to make it somebody who was, you know, was conflicted.
Yes.
And and I thought he did a good job of that, you know, that he wrote that in there nicely and things. So, but I mean, you know, I love that he added that dimension to it, but at the same time, what he brought to it really kind of, I don't want to say propaganda. It's not, you know, it's not just that. No. It's like he made it, you know, a war film. I felt like I was in a John Ford film, you know, so that was fun.
That's a great comparison because it definitely feels that way. It's an 80s version of that.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
At the end of the day, though, it really feels like war is pointless and that, it, you know, that's what the movie says to me, really.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And that was, again, that was his take on it. You know, we would have a lot of what we called Wolverine meetings at the end of every day. And all of us would get together in the hotel rooms and chill out and you know, tequila maybe and stuff like that. And, you know, we would have a good time. And John would be there in the middle of it, kind of, you know, talking about the work the next day, rewriting on some level a lot of the time and giving us images from other movies saying like, well, I thought about this movie, you know, and I thought about this from The Searchers and these other things and kind of, you know, really helping us understand what he was trying to achieve. And it was a lot of fun. One very memorable Wolverine meeting experience was Harry Dean, because Harry Dean was phenomenal to work with, right? Right. He played, played the father and, you know,
Avenge me.
That's right. Boys. He's the man. And he came to Santa Fe. He did the work. He had some friends in Santa Fe too, but we were there working and, he, you know, it was Harry Dean's last day, you know, he got killed and things. And
power just went out. He emailed.
Boys! Avenge me! Avenge me!
Hello?
Hello?
I don't think Harry Dean wanted me to tell that story.
Yeah, really?
I'm not sure.
You're like, Harry Dean and some prostitutes, and then the power went out.
Next question, exactly.
Let's go back to Joy of Sex. No.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Oh,
very
man.
Fortuitous.
Sorry about that.
No. It's all good. It's the power. It's the what we all have to deal with. Otherwise, you'd be here in the studio with us. And
that'd be great. That'd be great.
Really quick. So obviously, my buddy Trey Calloway was in The Outsiders, but and I want to get back to the Harry Dean story. You guys still stay in contact?
Yes. Love Trey. You know, I mean, I teach now, it just kind of happened. I started with one class and now I'm up to 4 days a week, at a place called LOXA, the Los Angeles County High School of the Arts.
Okay.
And, it's the best arts program in the country. And it has a cinematic arts program that's fantastic. I teach screenwriting and directing there.
Cool.
And one day this guy comes in for one of the master classes, you know, this like television genius. And he starts talking about how he got his start in The Outsiders. And I, you know, in the back of the room, of course, went, no, you didn't. I know you. Yeah. And then he goes, and it was Trey. I was like, of course. once I realized who he was, and it's just such a good guy. He's come in and spoken to the kids a few times. You know, this lockdown has changed teaching quite a bit.
Yes.
And, one of the bright spots has been that we can have people, you know, step in and zoom in and give master classes pretty easily. So we've had Trey in a couple of times, and he's just a fantastic guy. I love him so much. He's a cool dude. So I was happy to hook back up with him. And you know, one of the other associates is a doctor and stuff like that. I think we've all done pretty well for ourselves.
That's so cool because, yeah, for those that don't know, Trey Calloway is a phenomenal writer of, I mean, a myriad of television things.
Yes. CSI. Showrunner.
Showrunner. Yeah. And so it's and he had this minuscule role in The Outsiders, but holds it like a badge of courage. And
yes.
And they have at the original house, right, in Oklahoma, they have like conventions there. Not a convention, but like a meet and greets or...
Well, I'll tell you, this is the thing, because I was involved in kind of helping them to make that happen.
Oh, cool.
I sat down for another internet kind of podcast with a gentleman named Danny O'Connor.
Okay.
Right? Danny Boy O'Connor. He was one of the three founding members of House of Pain, right? Jump around.
Yeah.
And he's a big 80s fan. Yeah. He's got a group called Delta Bravo that
yes.
goes around and takes pictures, right? And
they're great.
They're great. I did his podcast and met him, and Nocco Nolan is kind of his sidekick on the podcast, and they were fantastic. And Susie Hinton called in during the podcast and stuff. It was great.
Wow.
And I think Susie's on the phone right now. No, I'm just kidding. but anyway, so about, I don't know, maybe a couple years later, I get a call from Danny, and he says, I went and I bought the Outsiders house. You know, he bought the house that, wow. that the Curtis brothers lived in. And it was a teardown. It was condemned basically at the time.
Oh my God.
And they did an amazing job. We've done fundraisers and different things there in Tulsa, and they restored it to look exactly the way it was in the movie. And it was a great process because it was like, you know, they stripped away some of the walls, and I could show them, well, this is where Francis Coppola cut away the wall so he could do the tracking shot of coming from inside to the outside of the house and stuff like that.
That's wild.
And, they do guided tours because all of the, the majority of the locations are right there around the house, you know, the park where the fountain was and Johnny's house and, you know, the park where the rumble happened and things like that. So they do these cool guided tours, and I went back and helped them do a couple of tours like about a year ago, and they just opened the house up. It's amazing. If you ever get to Tulsa, it's one of the things you got to check out.
Yeah, because I know Trey had gone back for one of their events and took pictures yep. with fans and whatnot. And I just thought, wow, I love that. You know, you think about iconic 80s homes like the house in A Christmas Story or obviously yeah. the house in Goonies. And the fact that, you know, I know the house in Goonies, those people are like, you know, don't take pictures or whatever. They're kind of a little bit more hesitant because I think people just live in that house, but
right.
But this is a landmark, and it is. I know every kid, and I'm sure, you know, growing up that it was required reading in elementary school. Like I think sixth grade or fifth grade. I was a teacher for many years, and I still work with kids, and occasionally I'll have a middle school student or a sixth grader bring out The Outsider. Oh, I have to read this book for my. For school project or what, and I'm like, no, you are lucky, dude.
The kids you're tutoring now,
the kids I work with, the kids I tutor, and they're like, is this any good? I'm like, well, let me tell you.
Well, it's the love it continues to get is amazing to me. I mean, that's why it was such a pleasure to be in it because, you know, here, what are we, 30, 35 years later, it still gets the same amount of love. And, you know, the parents pass it down to their kids I'll go speak to high school classes every once in a while. I know, you know, not long ago, C. Thomas and I went to Austin and spoke to a class so you just get continual love from that movie. It was a great, great film.
No jazz before the rumble. You know the rules, Ape Face.
We know. I want to talk to you.
Go ahead, I'll keep my eye on him.
Come on. What about you in the paper? How come?
I don't know.
I like playing a superhero or something.
I wouldn't have.
You wouldn't have what? I would have let those little kids burn to death.
Might not have. Might have done the same thing.
I don't know. Just don't know anything anymore, I guess. Just would have never believed a greaser could pull something like that.
Greaser didn't have nothing to do with it.
Check out their pants.
I'm talking sight. I couldn't tell this to anyone else. My friends, they think I was off my rocker or something. You know, that friend of yours, the one that got burned, he might die?
Yeah.
And tonight, you know, people get hurt in rooms, maybe even killed, right? You can't win. You know that, don't you? It doesn't matter if you whip us, you'll still be where you were before, at the bottom. We'll still be the lucky ones at the top with all the breaks. Doesn't matter. Greasers will still be greasers and socias will still be socias. It doesn't matter. Anyway, thanks, Grease. Hey, I didn't mean that. I meant thanks, kid.
Be nice talking to you, Randy. My name's Ponyboy.
You're still really tight with C. Thomas then, right? You guys obviously
can't shake him. I can't shake him.
You've been through so much together. You know, I feel like once you come out of Red Dawn, coming out of the Foxholes.
Once you've killed somebody on a mesa, you know, you're tight. You're tight.
I think that's the law.
No, he's a good guy. And we're still continuing to work together. We actually have a project that that I wrote that he's directing, you know, depending on what happens here with the pandemic and situation. That's early next year.
Oh, fantastic.
And and then I'm writing another project that he's excited about and stuff. So we work together a lot. He's a good guy. Listen, when I did The Outsiders with him, he was a punk and I was like, who is this kid? You know, he was just somebody that was stealing the cereal from me on, you know, from craft service. But when we kind of Red Dawn, it kind of came together, and we were roommates after that. And we've been really strong friends ever since. He's pretty much a brother.
Well, I think your two characters specifically have two of the biggest arcs in that film. You obviously go one way and he goes the other way, but both in this everyone's panic stricken. It's really interesting. And I think it's great that you guys still have this long relationship and, you know, you were in The Land That Time Forgot together. So,
yes, exactly. And, you know, it's funny because he's, you know, I tried to drown him. That's admittedly, I tried to drown him in the first movie. He has killed me so many times since that movie that it's like, it's not even funny. And so we did some movies like The Land That Time Forgot. We did the notorious Global Asylum, right? Who did Sharknado?
Oh yes.
And we had a blast doing I don't know, four or five movies for them. And there was one movie in particular because I was writing all of them, and I wrote it so that I would finally get to kill him, right? I would get to kill him.
This is awesome.
And somehow by the end of the movie, I wasn't killing him. You know, I think I probably ended up dying. I don't know how that works. So, but
did you also
good guy
direct that movie?
No, okay. I didn't.
So that first would track then. Why suddenly?
Yes,
you weren't. Like,
well, because he directed it. That's the thing. He directed it. So it's like
exactly.
I'm in control.
Yeah,
I'm in control.
Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah.
Like, well,
I can't.
Got a script change. I want to run by it, Aaron. Remember when you kill me? No, you don't do that anymore.
When you're gonna, you know,
exactly.
You always bring up
the dinosaur's gonna bite you in half. But wait, I'm supposed to kill you, and I'm gonna kill you in the next scene. He's like, no, that's not gonna happen.
I was going to say he also dragged you into the Soul Man too. So, you know, there's a whole other issue. But
yeah, that's another podcast. Well, but
You know, we actually had Ari Gross on a few weeks back and we talked about Soul Man with him, and Ari's fantastic. And we talked about how, you know, that film was way misrepresented and just in especially in the marketing. And just kind of, you know, obviously wouldn't be made today, or if it was, it would have a totally different look to it. I think it had a lot more going on other than how it was promoted, you know, to the masses.
Well, I think that was its original, You know, I think that was its original, you know, the idea behind it did have that kind of, you know, that sensibility.
Yeah.
I think the hard thing is, like, as things grow and as the world changes, you kind of have to go, yeah, that's not quite, you know, that's not quite politically correct anymore. But the cool thing about that movie and that period of time is that was when Tommy and I were roommates. And so anytime he would get a job or I would get a job, we'd pop up, you know, on the set. And, you know, I was doing a TV show for NBC at the time. And I remember I got him to stand next to me and I gave him a high five, like in one scene in a football game or something like that. And we would just kind of, you know, and Soul Man was the same way. He said, come down, we're going to play basketball today. And I came down there with he and Steve Miner and put on some shorts and played a little basketball. It was a lot of fun. But
are you talking about the TV show, The Best Times?
Best Times. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Which was, you know, again, a great, you know, great, the writers that did Lou Grant just had some really great people on it and a fun time, but short lived.
You were telling a Harry Dean Stanton story earlier.
Yes.
We did want to circle back to.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry.
Okay, good.
Derailed with C. Thomas.
So this is what happened. Exactly. Before, and I'll try this again, but if the power goes out, then I'm not going back into it, just so you know.
Deal.
And it could be worse. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm on the edge of my seat. but we had this big send off for Harry Dean. Like I said, we were, you know, we got a little inebriated and we had a great time and it was had a party. And then the next day we all had to go to work and he was supposed to get on a plane and go home. And we came dragging in at the end of the day, you know, covered in blood and mud and things like that. And there was Harry Dean in the hotel. And we said, you know, what happened? And he said, well, I had such a good time. I'm going to stick around. So he stuck around for like a couple more weeks because the Wolverine meetings, you didn't want to miss those. Yeah. He just hung out in Santa Fe for a while. Just a great character who I got to know better in the later years and things like that, and got to, you know, go to a lot of his band's performances and things like that. And he would come over to my wife and I's house, my ex-wife's and I's house and at parties, and we'd have so much fun. Just a great, great character.
Yeah. He's really actually fantastic. A lot more dynamic than I think people oftentimes, know him of. They think of like Pretty in Pink or Repo Man, but he's an artist, a true artist in the sense that like he's a musician and
well, and for me it was because one of my favorite movies of all time is Cool Hand Luke.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
So I always remember him, Cool Hand Luke, playing the guitar and, you know, being that dude, and so I was in awe of the guy, and you know, he was, but again, that was the general feeling of that movie was so. Together. We were all so together. It was very familial feeling in that movie. And that's one of the things that really stuck with me all these years later. I still look at it. I think of it very warmly in that way. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it's cool. He obviously was in awe of you guys if he stuck around for a couple more weeks afterwards just to hang with the crew.
Right. Well, you know, the liquor was cheap. It was good.
Well, yeah, that'll always draw you in, you know? So
yes.
I do want to jump a little bit ahead though. To talk about some of the projects you're working on now, because and I wanted to know, you're working on The Lurking Fear, right? Is that something that's still in development, or?
Yeah, no, it's something I directed not last summer, but the summer before, and then we were due to do some pickups and things like that to finish it out, and March came, and so it's in a little bit of limbo on that level. It was a big learning experience for me. It was a giant undertaking. We shot in Jacksonville, Florida, in a really decrepit, abandoned, I think it was a public school, but it looked like an asylum. And it was a lot of fun. Some great cast members and
Robert Davi,
and things like, speaking of Goonies, right? There you go.
Yeah.
And so I look forward to it. I don't know. It's kind of, you know, you get farther away from things. It's kind of hard to pick them back up again. It's hard.
Are you a fan of that genre, or is it?
I love horror. I do. I love horror. And it's like, I'm a big fan. It's an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, right? And so I had read the original H.P. Lovecraft and then and thought that I could apply this to a modern day setting. And so I adapted it, I don't know, a few years ago. And then someone, a producer named Michael Tadros, who picked it up and had kind of fell in love with it, really stuck with it for a few years, and then said, you know, you should direct it. And it was, I learned a lot. And one of the things that I learned more than anything was that I really do like directing. So I'll be doing that again.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
That's awesome. What are some of your favorite horror films? Just curious.
Man, I mean, I have so many, but I'm a big fan of like The Descent.
I'm
a big fan of Carpenter's The Thing, his version of The Thing.
Of course,
I was just talking to somebody about this not long ago. The last time I saw that movie was at the Hollywood Forever screenings, where you have them in the graveyard.
I was there.
There you go, right? You were probably the guy that I couldn't see over. I was like, come on, sit down, sit down.
I was the guy who's like, hey, you look like Neil Sean. No.
Shut
up, Neil Sean. I'll sit where I want to.
But I do love that genre. It's not my normal wheelhouse that I would maybe write in, but I did enjoy that. I did enjoy writing that script. It was a good one.
The Descent, by the way, is fantastic. I love that movie. And in HP Lovecraft is kind of hot right now with the Lovecraft series on HBO.
Lovecraft Country. I agree. I've always liked the stuff that was a little, I liked The Others. And I really liked that recent, not long ago, the Netflix series, The Haunting of Hill House. I thought that was phenomenal. It's a genre that I just think you can say a lot. It's a good genre for social commentary. And this movie has a certain social commentary because it basically portrays this almost cannibalistic culture that lives underground. Mm. And, for me, they were kind of like the 99%, what I mean? Like they just... it was an eat the rich type of thing.
Yeah, no
totally.
Doubt.
This, just a quick story about The Descent, personal story. Yeah. My wife and I, the first and last time we were ever in Buffalo, New York, not that I don't particularly hate Buffalo, but there was just not much going on. And we were downtown. We were there for a wedding. And we're like, what's going on? There's nothing going on in downtown. It's like August. It should be hopping. Where's the hoppin'ness? And we go, and there's a movie theater. It's playing The Descent. And we go in, and we buy some popcorn. And the person who sells the popcorn says, would you like me to start the movie now? And we're like, oh, are there no more people? Like, no, that's it. So we just, the two of us sit down in this theater that holds like 60 people. And the sound comes on, and it's like playing out of like desktop speakers on the floor. And it's like, and I'm like, this is terrible. And it totally like, it takes you out of the movie because, the audio isn't surrounding you. And I was like, I don't like this. I don't like this. And so the movie, the movie landed a little weak to me. So,
right.
Yeah.
And you never went back to Buffalo. I get it.
I haven't been back to Buffalo because of that.
I completely understand.
Thanks for indulging me, guys. Sorry, that's it.
Well, that's cause for a rewatch. So
it is
because
it
it's
is.
Very yes. anxiety inducing.
It is. And yeah. No, I didn't. Yeah, I felt anxiety because like, where's the sound?
Yeah.
The great guy, and a great movie. I loved. Yeah. I love Dog Soldiers. Which was his
Neil
the
Gordon
movie he
or
did.
Neil Marshall.
Yeah, Neil Marshall, and that was the movie he did before that, right? So, I love the horror genre. The place where I teach, Loxa, they just did a cinematic, they call it Cinema Scare Night. They have four major festivals, and they did Cinema Scare Night, and it's all centered around writing the horror stuff. And so I've been doing a lot of horror writing teaching right now.
Oh,
so
cool.
Just wrapping that up.
Well, it's you were saying that it wasn't necessarily what you initially were getting into. What initially kind of drew you into writing?
I mean, I was such a big reader when I was younger, when I was a kid. When I discovered reading, it altered my existence, And I grew up in a very small town in Wyoming. And so the library kind of held everything for me. And, it just my love for writing kind of grew out of my love for reading. And, you know, the way that I kind of got into it in film, it's the funny thing is when I got, you know, when I took those guys to the audition for The Outsiders and they said, you should come in. They said, you need a resume. You need to write a resume. And so I wrote up a resume on like a ring, you know,
napkin,
three ring binder type stuff. Yeah, basically. Right. And of course it was all just bullshit because I mean, I hadn't done anything. I wrote down, Romeo and Juliet in English class, whatever.
Yeah.
But I made up a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that I wrote, you know, special skills was screenwriting. I had never written a screenplay in my life at that point, but it was, you know, I look back on that sometimes now, stapled to the Polaroid that I took and say, okay, well, that was always something where I wanted to be. And it just happened that as I was going along, there was one project in particular where I did a little bit of rewriting for somebody. And then they basically said, you should come on and do some more writing. And it just grew. It just grew to something that I really love to do. So it's really where I live now. I love it.
I think that's beautiful that you're obviously doing what you love. And we've had quite a few people on here that talk about that they are doing what they love. And it's not easy. It's never easy. It's not supposed to be easy. But if you...
Plus, when you got kids, you know how it is. They want to eat every day. And you're like, you know, sometimes what you love doesn't pay enough to feed them all the time, you know, and stuff like that. But no, it's true. I'm extremely fortunate that, not only that I found a way into this business, but that it's continued to embrace me on certain levels. It's great.
What do you tell your students in as far as... because I'm sure you get a lot of students thinking, oh, I want to be the next, so-and-so. And like, what do you tell them? What kind of advice do you give them?
You know, I mean, I tell them, I really push them to suck. You know what I mean? I say, listen, you need to really be terrible and go through that. And don't try to be Spielberg because you're not there yet.
Yeah.
And that's like when we start getting into the sections where we're writing television or something like that, I say to them, listen, I understand you want to write Stranger Things now, but there's a stairway and Stranger Things is like up on the 10th floor. Right.
Yeah,
so you got to go through a lot of steps before you get there. And a lot of that is just doing, just practicing what you're doing. And so I think on some level they probably look at me and go, oh yeah, well, when you were our age, because I was when I was 16, Francis Coppola came and like stuck you in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Like, so you got a little bit of a head start, which is true, but at the same time, there's no shortcut to to really being good at what you love. That's the thing. You can love it, but you got to be, especially as a writer, you got to be willing to just do terrible work. I always tell them, you can't fix a blank page, but you can fix a bad script. So mm-hmm. just go write a bad script, do it. They surprise me. Listen, you said you were a teacher as well,
yeah.
Right? I find it to be one of the most rewarding, amazing things I've ever kind of, on some level, like The Outsiders, I kind of fell into it. The opportunity opened up and then it continued to invite me to do more of it. And they inspire me. You know what I mean? They remind me of what the reason that I was, that I was excited to do things when I was younger. And I think it's a real blessing to do. It is.
Yeah, it's a magical thing. I used to teach kindergarten, and then I was doing a school of rock class.
God.
Yeah, I had Trey's kids, one of his sons in my class when he was 5, obviously, and now he's like 17 or 18 going to Northwestern, which is a trip. But you think about like how much time has passed, or I did a school of rock class with these little kids, and meanwhile, like, who's going to be the next big, who's going to be the next Eddie Van Halen, or who's going to be the next, David Lee Roth or whatever. And hopefully not David Lee Roth, but you know what I'm saying? Like, the idea is like these kids, you're influential in their lives, whether you know it or not, you are, and you're having a big hand in that. And it's a beautiful thing, because you're seeing it right there. And now, obviously, as a parent, you're seeing that even more so, even if your son's playing Minecraft, it's like, still you're engaging with him. And the fact that you have this opportunity to see this being grow with your influence is pretty remarkable. And I think that shouldn't be taken for granted at all.
No, I agree. I agree. And it locks it. It's an interesting thing because it's, you know, it is in Hollywood. So it's got a lot of like last year I taught screenwriting to Roxy Sorkin. Wait a minute. So Sorkin, I'm going to teach you screenwriting. And you know, like one of Bill Macy's daughters went there,
that's surreal. Yeah.
You know, these are kids that I mean, it's a program that really is on a college level as far as the equipment and things that they would normally have to be able to work their films with and stuff. So it's really a pleasure to be a part of it. Great faculty and stuff like that. Too.
That's so, really cool. It's funny. You just jarred a memory of me. I was doing, because Dustin and I both do voice acting, and I was giving I was at a summer camp doing a thing with young people about voice acting. And one of the kids was like, "What's your favorite voice to do?" You know, and I was just doing my impressions of things I've admired on television or
just
movies.
Bart Simpson.
Yeah. Right. Come on, man. Yeah. So I said, well, what voices do you guys like? You know? And then one of the kids is like, do Batman. Cause Batman Lego movie had just come out. So I did my Batman impression, and one of the kid's hands in the back goes up and he goes, "That's my dad." And I go, "Your dad's Batman?" He goes, "Yeah, my dad's Batman. Will Arnett, he's Batman." And I go, "Oh," I said, how did I do it? He goes, "That's pretty good." Like, all right, cool. Anyways,
you're my dad now.
I was gonna say, Darren, you know, obviously you wouldn't be on our show if it wasn't for our good buddy Peter Hackman. He's a dear friend of ours, and we met him through our Vince DiCola, who's an amazing composer and musician and world renowned, right, in my opinion. But it really means so much that you came on our show and talked about everything that we did today. It was fantastic.
I love it. Listen, talking about those movies, and that era of movies was just so, it was so, things were so good.
It's our
favorite. And I know, like we mentioned Blockbuster, you know, the pre-Blockbuster, if you remember, was, you know, they had all these shelves that they had to fill with videotapes, and it was awesome because they were just making movies left and right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they had to fill these shelves. Blockbuster came along, kind of curbed that a little bit because they were like, well, I'm going to take these sections and 18 of them are going to be, you know, Mission Impossible 8, yeah, you know, so that it dropped a little bit, you know, but that era of movies was just so enjoyable, man. It has a wonderful, warm place in my heart, not only as someone who was in the movies, but someone who watched the movies. I loved it. So I appreciate the podcast. I dig it.
Well, I think we have, that's one of the reasons why we do this, is we want to remind people of that nostalgic love. And also, it's not the fact that we don't look at you and go, "Oh, you were this guy in the 80s. No, you have had quite a career. It's just such a memorable time. Like you said, it's such a loving time for us. So we look back and go, "Oh man, that gives us all the feels." And that's
why
we're trying to do.
Yeah. That's why
bring
we do
some
it.
Joy yeah. to people's lives.
Well, you're kicking its ass. I love it.
Well, thanks. But
keep going.
Oh, that's the plan, right, Dustin?
Keep it going. Grow it. Expand it.
Well, Darren, awesome, this has really been a treat, and want to thank you again. And hopefully we can do this again and be in person.
Anytime. And the next time that Tommy and I are together, that we're in the same room, I'll give you guys a shout out and we can do something quickly or something like that.
That'd be cool. You know, actually, that would be great if we had the two of you guys and just swap stories about being in the 80s and
or whatever.
Wild times.
Whatever you guys want to do, really. We're at your, you know, we're open and receptive to whatever.
And Darren,
I'll do it.
We'll eat some bugs together, whatever.
That's right.
Yeah.
Eat some bugs, try to drown some greasers. Yeah. It'll be fun.
Drink some tequila. Yeah. Okay.
I want to wish you guys the best of luck with it and everything like that. And thanks for reaching out.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Take care.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe and give us a is it 5-star rating? Don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you listen to us on Spotify, that's great too. And you can find us on the internet. Don't forget to check out our website at $2LateFee.com and follow us on Instagram and Facebook at $2LateFeePodcast. We'll see you next time.
We did it.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.